Blog Talk Radio.
Here, listening to you.
Okay. I'm sorry, you guys. My co-host is supposed to be, he's trying to call in, and he's saying, they're saying there's no show scheduled. And the show is scheduled because we're on the air right now.
Would that be Brian?
Yes, that would be Brian.
Yeah. Hello, Brian. How you doing, brother?
He can't call in right now because he's saying that it's saying that there's no show scheduled, and me and you are sitting here talking right now. So it's got to be something. They wouldn't even let me open up my studio if I didn't have a show going on. Hold up. He's trying to call me again. Yes. Yes.
It's me, Salita, Victory Houston.
I'm 347.
I'm trying to reach Brian. Hello? I think they lost me. Hello? Worried about Brian. Hello? I guess I better call.
Okay, you guys, I am so sorry. Are you guys there? Hello? Hello? Are you
Hello?
Guys there? Yes.
I'm here, Salita.
Okay, let me tell you something. This is not
I'm
me.
Here.
This is okay, can you hear me?
Brian?
You guys?
Yeah.
Okay.
Not to cause all this confusion, trying to call in. They lost me. I called back.
Yeah,
calling in as a late bird.
Well, I couldn't get
talking about there ain't no show
wrong
today.
Number.
That's the second time, huh? You got
to
type Brian
I had to blame
up
that on
the phone numbers.
Look,
I had to blame
look,
that on the host.
I had to call back. Now.
Okay, listen. Before we get started, you guys. Look,
okay.
The thing happened was they knocked me out, too. I don't know what Brian did, but it knocked me out, too. So,
mm-hmm.
I'm blaming this on Brian.
Oh,
okay.
Yeah. Pull one of them switches off them trees down there and pull the leaves off and hit him on his backside.
I'll take that one. I'll take that one.
No, that might remind us of slavery. Don't do that.
Look.
that might bring back some bad memories. Don't do that. Well, how you doing, brother?
I'm doing good. Doing good.
Okay. Yeah.
Doing good.
That's great.
So okay.
We gonna get the show on the road, Salita, or what?
Get me on a landline phone.
Yeah, we ready to roll. Brian about.
We gotta wait on Brian again.
I hope not. You
Brian,
together,
you
Brian.
Hold on.
I am gonna switch numbers in a little bit though, Salita. So I'm letting you know.
Okay. All right. That's fine. I hope that don't interfere with what we're doing here. Anyway. Okay, you guys. Mr. Houston, I would like for us to start the show out by you telling us a little bit about yourself first and foremost before we actually get into the interview.
Okay. Is the listening public listening?
Yes, they're listening.
At this very moment?
Yes.
Okay. I didn't realize. I thought we were still having technical difficulties.
No, we're good for right now. What is that noise in the background? I keep hearing
I don't know.
Like,
I hear it sounds like the ocean is next door or something.
Yeah, the ocean, yeah.
Is that you
Brian.
Again?
Yep. It's Brian.
I was muted out, so it wasn't me.
Okay, it just
I'm
went away.
Okay.
Who did something? Somebody did something.
Yeah, it's something you're
okay.
doing. Your mute
I'm
didn't
mute
working right because we
now
hear
it's coming back
the
a little bit.
Okay,
yeah,
go ahead,
cut
baby.
The bad water off, Brian. Anyway, this is Victor Houston. a little bio about myself. I'm born and raised in Oakland, California. I joined the Black Panther Party in October 1967. I was basically doing an infant state of the party's growth and development. And I became one of the national organizers for the Black Panther Party. I think it had a lot to do with what my family gave me in terms of just an ability to express myself. And the things that got me involved in the movement in the first place was a thing that I saw in America that was taking place. The Watts riot had just started in Los Angeles, and a lot of people didn't realize it, but Oakland also rioted during the same time that Watts went up in smoke in 1965. And so all these things, the assassination of Malcolm X in 1964 at Audubon Ballroom in New York, the killing of Emmett Till in Money, Mississippi in 1957, all these things had an effect on my life personally. And what was most troubling to me as an individual, realizing that blacks were suffering in so many different facets in this society, from unemployment to discrimination in housing, education, in the military, was when police, those supposedly here to protect and serve the public, were committing murders, and that these were basically racist white men in police uniforms committing these extrajudicial killings. And so that brought me to the strong movement of the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense, which is how the party started, and then it became a full political party and became the Black Panther Party. And so that's where I got my start. I'm proud to say one of my most profound statements, that our struggle continues. And at 62 years of age, God's blessed me with good health, and I'm still involved in this struggle. Most of you know out there that all around this country, almost on a daily basis, our people are still being murdered, unjustified murders by police officers violating the Fifth Amendment and the 14th Amendment. Salita, was that enough bio?
Yes, it was. Yes, it was. You did an excellent job. Now, let's talk about... You were talking about the police brutality, and I know you're very passionate about that, and you're very knowledgeable about the ideal that we have this problem, this epidemic, because it's no longer a problem, it's actually an epidemic, of the loss, the losing of our African-American men, women, and children now to the same ones who are supposed to be able to protect us, guide us, be that shining star in situations that we need to be able to get out of safely. And we find that they're no longer doing that. Now, do you think, this is my question to you, do you think the mentality, or there is a mental breakdown? You know, we talk about the military and how we soldiers come back and we're not the same. Do you think there is a breakdown, a mental breakdown in the way police now handle things, no matter how much you teach them, no matter how much you guide them, they're still having issues with dealing with us as African Americans, as our male, female children? Do you think that there's something underlying with that?
Yes, I do. And the fact is that America has institutionalized racism, it's deeply embedded in the American society and in the culture of this country. And this makes for no change in terms of racism being on America's police departments. Fact alone, there's never been anything done in American history. There's been no educational programs, no projects, no... Nothing has ever been done to eradicate this institutionalized racism in American society. And as we go further back into time, the extreme nature of these extrajudicial killings by the police gets even worse. And so, you know, it's one thing to wear a uniform and another thing for a person to be in the uniform who, from his own cultural background, from the community that he came from, his upbringing, that he hated blacks. They do not screen. There's no testing to find out if these police officers belong to any white Aryan nation, any Ku Klux Klan organizations, if they're racist, whether or not they hate blacks or Latinos or Asians or any other. Nothing has ever been in place to screen them, to make sure that this is not upon America's police department. This is one of the big problems. Now, basically, I had prepared to discuss from a historical perspective currently, and also a vision for the future showing how there probably will be no change in this area. Let's go back to 1968 when the federal government was very much in shock when the all of the riots around the United States, Cleveland, Ohio, Washington, D.C., Watts, Detroit, when American ghettos and were just going up in flames all around this country. And so they did a study. It was a study that was paid for and implemented by the U.S. government. It was called the Kerner Commission. You might remember that, Zelita, the Kerner Commission study. And this was a study to find out the cause of the rioting. The government wanted to know what was causing all of these rebellions in the ghettos. Why were blacks burning down their own neighborhoods? And what they found in their summary, that there was two separate but unequal communities in America, one black and one white, and that what had sparked all of these riots was racism, a racist police officer shooting to death, normally some young black teenager, a man, woman, or a child. And here it is almost 50 years later, and the exact same things are continuing after almost a half a century. We know about Trayvon Martin. We recently experienced, and people are sobbing over the murder of Kamani Kiki Gray, the little 16-year-old who was shot to death up in New York, unarmed. We know about Oscar Grant out in Oakland, who was face down on the BART platform, shot in the back by Johannes Messerly, who only received 11 months in the county jail for that murder. We know about Trayvon Martin, for example, which is a very high-focus political case that's coming up June 10th. One of the things I want to point out that's very important about all of these killings is that in the broader vision, the broader perspective of looking at all of this, we find that the district attorneys, the prosecutors, the state prosecutors, routinely do not charge these police officers for doing this killings. And the mayor, no one is being held accountable, from the mayor, the city manager, the whole city government. There's a breakdown in the rule of law. The tyranny exists from the mayor down, and even the governor of the state. And the proof of this is that the federal government has put the federal consent decree on several major police departments around the United States. They did it in Los Angeles. The federal consent decree is the federal government telling a city, like the city of Los Angeles, which is the second or third largest city in the United States, that the mayor, the city council, the city manager, the district attorney, the whole structure of the city government has failed the general public in providing the safety in their police departments, protecting and serving the community, and that the breakdown and the dysfunction of the city government is so bad that they have to put total federal oversight over the city of Los Angeles, that they cannot hire their own police, they can't fire anyone, the payroll, everything, the logistics is totally controlled by the federal government. So this is an admission. These are facts that we are looking at.
Wow.
To testify to the fact that it's not just the murders by those individual officers, that the breakdown is throughout the whole city government. They also did this to the Oakland Police Department. You remember I think it was the Ryder's case in Oakland. Police officers who out just committing murders and brutalizing black. They did it in New Orleans. They put the federal consent decree on the New Orleans police. They did it in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. So here again, they're pointing to whole major cities where there's a breakdown. So now we have tyranny. We have the oppression by those whole governments that's supposed to be protecting and serving the people. So now where does that leave the masses of the American people? That means that we, the people, basically have to take up that Second Amendment right. And I want to point out that it doesn't just simply say that blacks have a right or American public have a right to bear arms. The very first thing it says, if you read it, is that we have a right to have a well-regulated militia to protect the people of the state. And they wrote this because at the time when it was tyranny from the British government, when they wrote, you know, those founding fathers that the conservatives are always talking about, when they wrote these things, they knew that this could happen later in history, that if this ever happened again, well, those in government who are supposed to have been serving the people, there was a breakdown in the rule of law, and tyranny would prevail over the people, that they wanted the people to have that right to throw off this tyranny and defend themselves. This is where our people at, in my opinion, they are at today. Because you know what? These murders have never stopped. They're going to continue. I just got a call yesterday. I was very happy from Adam Bluford. Adam Bluford is the father of Alan Bluford, the young 18-year-old black man who was shot dead by the Oakland police last May in Oakland. MC Hammer knew this family very well, and there was a lot of hurt and a lot of anger toward the Oakland police for killing this young man who was unarmed. It was right on the top of the Oscar Grant murder and also the barber Derek Jones. When we realize that these murders will continue, we realize that it's upon us as a race of people that we have no choice but to take a grassroots approach, a people's movement, a resistance movement, to finally ending all of these killings. I really believe that there's a big backlash from Barack Obama winning the second term and even a first term in office. It seems like the hatred, the attacks on blacks in so many different ways. There's the tempo of the murders has picked up since this man has been in office. We can cite many, many examples around the country. And not only attacks by those in uniform, but attacks by individual racist white men, like the young man in Jacksonville was shot dead for playing his music too loud. Or the black woman there in Louisiana who just before the election was wearing an Obama T-shirt. She was out jogging. And they snatched her and burned her up. We have no choice as a people but to defend ourselves. The Black Panther Party has always stood for that. Most of us were veterans coming home from the war. And I think that when you go fight for this country or you serve this country's military and you come back home where your family and your children live, the last thing we're going to do is sit around and not be men and not be strong and stand up to defend ourselves. And, you know, this has been going on so long. We have heard this so repeatedly, so routinely on a daily, a monthly, a yearly basis for the last, as I mentioned, a half a century, that I don't see any end in sight. I want to turn the conversation to American foreign policy.
Okay.
And I want to discuss this because what America does on an international level in terms of playing world police with these other countries will eventually hit home and therefore possibly be some collateral damage to American citizens. For example, currently we have a threat from North Korea. I think they last spoke that they're going to hit us with a sledgehammer. So I wanted to do a little historical critique and take our listeners around the world and point out some things that they might not know from a revolutionary perspective. Otherwise, the other side, the other voice, what's normally not in the media in discussing America's foreign policy. At the turn of the century, as you know, the Americans had adopted what they referred to, you remember Theodore Roosevelt, the big stick policy. They must have attacked every country south of the border. They went into Nicaragua. They were being supported by Somoza, the Somoza regime down there in 1917. And so the poor and oppressed people in that country, led by Augusto César Sandino, rose up and to try to overthrow this puppet for the U.S., Somoza. And as a result of it, the U.S. Marines occupied Nicaragua, and people died in that war of resistance against U.S. occupation. At the same time, in Haiti, one President Doe, he was a puppet for the U.S. in Haiti, and the Haitians went to the palace. They drug him out of there. They beat him to death, and the U.S. used this as an excuse, and they sent the U.S. Marines into to the Dominican Republic and into Haiti. All throughout Mexico, revolution was going on from 1910 to 1919. You've heard of Francisco Villa, Pancho Villa, who was in the north with the workers and the peasants fighting the ruling class, and Emiliano Zapata was in the south. So General Pershing crossed the border, leaving right here in El Paso, and they fought wars in Mexico. At the same time, they launched a war against Spain in Cuba, the Battle of San Juan. Who told America to be the police for the world? As time moves forward, shortly after World War II, you find America with more police actions in Korea, Vietnam. All over the globe, you see the United States military occupying foreign countries, playing world police. The countries that they didn't have actual American soldiers in boots on the ground, they would organize what they referred to as proxy armies, or they would have covert operations to destabilize, or that French term, coup d'etat, and overthrow governments like they did in Ghana being the first country in Africa liberated from European colonialism, the British, in 1957. And when the leader of that freedom struggle, Kwame Nkrumah, left to go visit the Chinese leader, the CIA coup d'etat at his country in Ghana. Patrice Lumumba in the Congo. As you know, the Belgians had occupied the Congo, still in rubber and cobalt and other natural resources. History shows King Leopold murdered over 10 million Africans, cutting off limbs and arms, doing all types of genocidal crimes against our people there. Patrice Lumumba was the freedom fighter there. He came to power and rallied his people against Belgium, and Americans sent their CIA over there, and they murdered Patrice Lumumba. He gave him the firing squad, chopped his body up in little pieces, put it in sulfuric acid, and they burned him up. And another important thing is that the same time period, 1960, as you know, Fidel Castro and Ernesto Che Guevara from Argentina launched the Cuban Revolution, which was a success. And all of those anti-Castro Cubans under Fulgencio Batista came to Miami, and it was a surplus of mercenaries that the CIA used, and some of them they gave beef 17 bombers, and they sent them back to the Congo, and they were bombing the forces of Patrice Lumumba. We look to the Philippines, and we see the puppet Marcos. Marcos was a puppet in the Philippines, him and his wife Imelda. I think the story goes she had over 5,000 pairs of shoes. You look in El Salvador. Duarte was the puppet there for American corporations to suck the natural resources out of El Salvador, while the poor and oppressed people led a resistance movement led by a guy named Faramundi Marti. So again, a war was launched there. The Sandinistas came to power in 79 under Daniel Ortega in Nicaragua. And again, under Ronald Reagan's presidency, and you remember Oliver North, and one CIA operative in Honduras named Juan Negro Ponte launched a war from Honduras into Nicaragua. They killed over 100,000 Nicaraguans with that war with the Contras that the U.S. financed. And statistics show that half of them were children. That means 50,000 children perished in Ronald Reagan's war against the Contras.
Mm-hmm.
South Africa launched a war toward Angola. Joseph Santos was the leader in Angola. Our country supported the wrong side. They were on the side of the apartheid regime in South Africa. And Joseph Zimbenvi led a group of black mercenaries that fought with the white South Africans against the freedom fighters under Joseph Sante in Angola. It was called UNITA. So everywhere we look around the world, we see America supporting the political far right, just like they've
have
done
we
in
ever
this country.
Have we ever supported anything right?
Yeah, they supported the far right, but no. So this is a pattern that we see. In 1953, Kermit Roosevelt, he was the grandson of Theodore Roosevelt. He was a CIA agent, and him along with Norman Schwarzkopf overthrew the Democratic elected government of Iran in 1953. Mohammad Mossadegh was the president there. There wasn't no Ayatollahs in Iran. The British, along with the Americans, I think Dulles was the head of the CIA, they wanted Iran's oil deposits. And after successfully overthrowing through a coup Mohammad Mossadegh, they installed a Shah, Shah Perez, and he ruled brutally for over 30 years. And the British, and along with the Americans, they established the, it was called the Anglo-Persian, because it was the Persians in Iran, the Anglo-Persian Oil Company, and that became British Petroleum. BP started with the atrocities committed in Iran. So when we look at the present policy and the lies that America is putting out, the perception management that Iran is trying to develop a nuke and Iran is building nuclear weapons so that they can do this and that and destroy Israel, it's all a lie. It's all propaganda. You go back to the beginning and you look at the background and you go to 1953 and you can see the truth and what the real policy is against Iran. East, west, north, and south, we know those are directions on a compass. So when America said North Vietnam, South Vietnam, that's one culture of people, the Vietnamese people, one language. Ho Chi Minh was a nationalist. He first loved and cared about his people. He had no choice but to reach out to the Russians to try to get military support to defeat the French. The French had occupied Indochina, Laos, Cambodia for over 120 years, and they got defeated in a big battle called Dinh Ban Phu. They wiped out 15 French divisions on the beach. Here comes America being world police again, lying to the American public, saying that the North Vietnamese had attacked naval ships at the Gulf of Tonkin, which was a damn lie. Nothing had happened, just an excuse to lie to the American people to get them involved in the war. And it was a war that was unwinnable. Go ahead.
No, I just wanted to say, now, so what I'm getting, gathering from what you're saying is the ideal that we go around to different countries, we plant people in places that have been, these people that they choose to run these countries, they're actually been people that we know in America that we've done things with, CIA, FBI, or whatever little organizations that they have. So they're very familiar with these people. That's why they're able to put them where they want to put them.
And George W. Bush, the father, if you remember, he was the head of the, he was the DDP, that stands for Deputy Director of Planning. That's the top position in the CIA. There's a picture of George Bush standing right next to the door. At the same time the bullet hit John F. Kennedy, Bush is standing there right next to the door when Oswald's supposed to be up in the school book depository shooting him. He very much was involved with that assassination. He lied about his time in the CIA. And this is another reason why his son and the, remember the vote count in Florida?
Yeah, yeah.
The reason why his son became the president because the father, who was the head of the CIA, helped pull a coup in America to get his son in office. Remember, the American people's vote did not count. They took it completely out of the hands of the American people, and they let the court decide, even after the Supreme Court themselves had professed to believe in states' rights, an old Jeffersonian policy saying that the states had a right to make the final decision without the Supreme Court ruling over the state Supreme Courts. So they were very hypocritical in their own policy, and in their pajamas and underwear went to court on a Saturday and froze the vote count in Florida, and George Bush became the president. And so when we look at the assassinations of Robert Kennedy at the ambassador, John F. Kennedy, Ron Brown, how his plane went down when he was going to Kosovo.
Yeah, I remember that.
John F. Kennedy Jr., when his plane suspiciously crashed in the ocean, had that boy ran for president, John F. Kennedy Jr., he would have won it. They knew it. They snuffed his life out before he can do it. So here we have a pattern that the conservatives, those that's on the far right, those that's holding on, the conservatives means what? No change. Keep it in its original form. And what was its original form? White supremacy. Going back hundreds of years in this country, and they're in shock, they're in denial right now, because they have their first black president. And even though our first black president is black, black people have not received any real substance. I actually think Clinton actually gave black people more substance than Barack Obama has done. We're proud to see this man break the back of white supremacy in the White House. But the reality is, he haven't put a dime in or a nickel or a bowl of beans on black people's table. We have color in the White House. We have a different culture. And on the international scene, he's doing the same as his predecessor white president, ordering the bombing of an African country in Libya. Go ahead. You want to say something?
Yeah, I was going to say, hey, Brian, what you doing? What are you doing?
Well, we got a little noise in the background,
now.
Brian.
I'm doing something.
Because when you mute out, we hear you're muting, and it makes noise when you mute out. That's why I'm saying that.
I'm
going to mute out until I get to a landline.
Okay, leave it just
it
is, Brian. We can hear clearly.
Okay.
Can I continue, Salita?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. And so what I'm pointing out, for example, is that the people in the Twin Towers that died on 9/11 were innocent. But the thing that the American government is doing, the international crimes that they're committing around the world and have been for decades, are causing people of the world to seek retaliation and revenge. And they're calling that retaliation and revenge terrorism. There's no such thing. Let's take, for example, Vietnam. We went to war in Vietnam because we said that it was a domino effect. Communism was spreading. Remember, it was right beyond the 50s during the McCarthy era when America's world enemy was communism, from Russia to anywhere there was a communist government. And after killing 2 million Vietnamese, if the Vietnamese people had snuck agents into the United States and pulled off something like 9/11, after we killed 2 million of them because of our world police action, wouldn't it have been more fitting to call it retaliation and revenge? Many countries around the world have received atrocities from the United States. Remember, Reagan sent the 6th Fleet and they overthrew Grenada. They killed Maurice Bishop. They overthrew his government. They tried to overthrow Castro, but they weren't successful. Many countries have received atrocities from the Americans playing this world police. They just haven't retaliated. Most of them will go to their God and pray that one day justice will be served for the things that America's done. But now that they're dealing with the Islamic world, they have a different culture, and these people believe in taking action. And so now they've been hit by suicide bombers and all types of other attacks against the United States. When America points their finger at North Korea, when they point their finger at Iran, and they say that these are rogue countries, as Bush described them, the axis of evil, But you don't see one North Korean soldier. You don't see one Chinese soldier off its geographical boundaries. They only stay within their sovereign boundaries of their country and defend themselves. The aggressor is the one who takes their armies to another country and attacks and kills other nationals from other nations based on whatever they justify it. And who do we see doing that? The American people need to quit being naive and be honest with themselves. We see the United States has been doing this for decades and centuries. And another factor in that is always people of color. Mm-hmm. It's always dropping their bombs on people of color. We're the only ones that ever dropped a weapon of mass destruction on anyone, Hiroshima and Nagasaki. But yet still they're telling Iran they're going to bomb them if that's their last option before they let them develop a nuke. They're telling North Korea to bury their nukes. Countries are watching America. They see them attacking one country after another, and they're sitting back telling themselves, if you come over here, we got something to defend themselves. This is the position that basically the North Korea has taken. They only defend themselves. You don't see their navies and their armies occupying other countries. Ella Louise Strong was a very famous newspaper correspondent. She interviewed Mao Zedong, the Chinese leader, in 1959. She said this. She said that the U.S. has occupied China's territory in Taiwan for the past 9 years. She's saying this in 1959. She says also the U.S. has its military forces in Lebanon. She goes on to point out, Mao goes on to point out, that every U.S. military occupation on foreign soil or so many nooses around the neck of U.S. imperialism, and that the longer that they remain in these places, the tighter the noose around their neck shall become, like Afghanistan, for example, and it was getting very tight in Iraq, and that if the U.S. monopoly capitalists, here again he's actually referring to the military-industrial complex, continues their wars of aggression, he says sooner or later they're going to be hung by the people of the world. This is what we're starting to see happen. It's very interesting that just a couple of months ago, the U.S. was contemplating taking military action in Syria, saying that the last straw was that if the Syrians were starting to use their chemical weapons, that they were going to have to go over there if they didn't do nothing but start a bombing campaign. And as you know, they've been discussing what they're going to do in Iran, whether or not Israel was going to attack to try to knock out their nuclear facilities, and Obama's leaving the option open that if they have to, they'll take military action against Iran. All of a sudden, with a very strong threat from North Korea, the United States have tabled all of this aggressive action. Have you noticed that? I find that very, very interesting that all of a sudden you hear no talk about Syria and you hear no talk about attacking Iran. Now the focus has shifted to the Asian world because North Korea is telling us that they're going to attack us. How real that is remains to be seen. I really don't think they're bluffing. And so this recent attack by these two Chechens at the Boston Marathon was an act of that they're calling terrorism. Now, what the United States has done in the Russian world, I don't know that these people would hate the U.S. so much. I really can't point a finger and say that we've done anything in that area around Russia. It could just be a built-up hatred because supposedly they believe in Islam, and America's been attacking the Islamic world, and maybe that's where this retaliation and revenge attack came from. But again, what we're experiencing is a retaliation and a revenge of these countries because of America's foreign policy.
Okay, I have a question.
I'm going to stop right there and you ask some questions. Go ahead.
You were saying earlier about us having an African-American president in the office and how he's not done enough for African-Americans. And my thing is with him, and I used to be very much so in him as far as listening to his speeches and stuff, I totally stopped listening to him because I think he knows that he's ignoring his color and he's doing it because he has to do it, not because he wants to do it. I think because he has to do it. He knows what he is. He knows that what he's that they originally had about him when he first came in. He knows
because
he
tone. Yep.
The tone has changed a lot when he come as the president.
For example, now
Bush,
he's talking about attacking entitlement programs and touching Social Security. And
right.
There was an interview with Tavis Smiley, and Tavis Smiley pointed out something very key about Obama and how he deals with our people, black people, compared to how he deals with others. And he said this: Obama had addressed the, I think it was the national, the Black Caucus, okay? And he told them in his presentation, he said, stop complaining. You probably remember this, Salita.
Yes.
Stop bitching. Stop bitching. Uh-huh. Stop complaining. And put your marching shoes on and get back out here and do this and do that and this and the other.
Yes.
Tavis pointed out, he says, well, listen, when you talk to the Latino population, you don't tell them to quit bitching, quit complaining about immigration policies.
Yep.
Or the DREAM Act, or things that concern their race. When you talk to the homosexuals, you don't tell them to quit talking about their right to have same-sex marriages, but you want to tell black people, our people, to quit bitching, quit complaining, put your marching shoes on. And I found that a very key point in this man's approach to how he deals with black people. He has really done very little much of anything to relieve the suffering, especially in employment, of black people. Because when they talk about the percentage of employment, we're always three times the rate. He also acts like he ignores the facts of history. Bombing, ordering the bombing of an African country in Libya and basically killing of Gaddafi, given the French all the horrible things that France have done to African people all over the continent and in the Caribbean and in around throughout Asia, that he would dare give logistical support to the French shows either he's ignorant of history or he just acknowledges that he stands with those who are oppressing us. And I don't think he's ignorant of history because he's very astute. And so it comes down to the fact that he has some very evil policies toward our race, and you see it when it comes to the international things that he does. Now, we know that the Republicans have obstructed him in almost everything he's tried to do here domestically at home. But when you can really see the Obama as an individual, when he's able to make decisions around the world without that obstruction by the Republicans, those decisions are his and his alone. And it's not to say that he's not a puppet, Salita, and he has handlers. But it is to say that there he has a lot of choices in the decisions he makes because he didn't have to order, because he's a commander-in-chief, he didn't have to order the U.S. military to give the French logistical support when they recently went into Mali in Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And also the new onslaught on Africa by AFRICOM, which is very much U.S. designed. This is the latest thing, and they're keeping that on the down low. Also, the NDAA here domestically, which is the government's being able to spy on American citizens. And now they just passed another law. I forgot the initials for it.
Facebook.
Right, on the internet, where they're actually able to right. And then when you look at when you look at these policies,
he wanted to know what it was. It's called CISPA.
Right, CISPA.
While we were fighting, we were talking about the bombing, they were passing laws in the midst of what
right,
was going on
right.
with bombing. It was a distraction.
It was very much a distraction. Perception management is how the government, the mass media, and those in control manage how the American public will perceive things. And they have gone on a frenzy in this latest bombing at the Boston Marathon. And there's a reason for that, because they're trying to mold into the minds of the American people this hatred for terrorism. And what this does is it smokescreens all of these aggressive actions by the United States and the U.S. military occupying all these countries and doing all these horrible things, and we know what the motivations are. Because all of the countries in the last decade that's been under attack are oil-rich countries. When Bush was the president, George Bush, Walker Bush, W's father, and they went into Somalia. You remember the film they made, Black Hawk Down? I remember clearly that they were supposedly going to feed the people from starvation. And then it changed and that they wanted to disarm the warlords. Now, why would they want to do that? And that's when the conflict started, because they wanted to get at Somalia's oil. You know Bush was the oil man. When they ordered the bombing of the Sudan, Sudan is another oil-rich country. That's another OPEC country. The assassination, which I believe they gave the Venezuelan president a heart attack.
Hugo Chavez.
Hugo Chavez. Yeah, he had cancer. Right. The Cubans had that under control, but he died of a heart attack. He didn't die of cancer. And Maduro, the new president, said that the CIA murdered him. All of that to get that Citgo oil down there. Everywhere there's oil in the ground, there's conflict. Saudi Arabia, Iran, Iraq.
Let me ask you a question, Ms. Houston. I was noticing the reports where when Venezuela just had the recent election, that candidate that was, they claimed, handpicked by Chavez, won. And
by 51%,
a couple of hundred votes or something like that.
No, about 275,000 votes.
Okay. And
he won by 51%.
The one that he ran against, he claimed that he wanted to normalize relations with America. Do you have any insight on how that played out?
He's been the representative of he's the far right in Venezuela. Okay, he's the far right, and so. As America tries to get control again of that country, as I pointed out when I went around the world talking about how they always are supporting the right-wing element in those countries. Remember what they did in Chile. It was against Salvador Allende in 1973. They murdered him, and who did they support? General Pinochet, who murdered, slaughtered over 30,000 activists down there. Everywhere you look around the world, you see America working with the leaders of these countries as right-wing, who normally control the military over the masses of the suffering people. And those are the ones that's usually launching a revolutionary or resistance movement against that tyranny of those particular governments. We're always on the far right. I remember when Mel Zelaya, because I lived in Honduras, they accused him of trying to hook up with Daniel Ortega and the Sandinistas right next door, and 11 Republican congressmen traveled to Honduras to support, I think his name was Garcia. He was the one that took control of the military, though, basically what they call the junta, and had illegally ran Mel Zelaya, the elected president, out of the Honduras government. He went underground in Nicaragua, and then he came back later. So this is a pattern. And when we look at our own country inside America, we see the same pattern. John F. Kennedy was the first Catholic president. He was the first one to really speak out for the rights of black people. You remember back in the 60s, everybody had that piece of carpet-looking, velvet-looking, it wasn't a painting. It looked like a rug, but it had John F. Kennedy's pictures on it. You remember those, Salita? Everybody had one on their wall. It was the first time we'd actually had a black president, a president who actually stood up for some of the civil rights of black people. And black people loved Kennedy. They killed him. They killed his brother. They killed Martin Luther King. They killed Malcolm X. Anybody that's politically left of the center that doesn't support the conservative element, it's been commonplace that assassinations have taken place and all types of other illegal things to take these people from power. And we see that domestically, and we see that internationally. And so we have a big problem in this country. And I want to point out also that if we remember history, none of the things have been accomplished by elected politicians in this country. Otherwise, the things that are inclusive of black people, the issues that concern our people, those things, what's the word, parity, those things have always been championed by people who were not elected into political office. It wasn't in the political arena. Dr. King moved mountains. So did Malcolm. So did Fannie Lou Hamer. So did many other activists. And none of those individuals held any political office. And the same goes for today. We have to learn from those lessons of the past and realize that it's only going to be through grassroots efforts. It's only going to be by people like ourselves, like what you guys are doing right now with this radio station, by being able to bring the truth to the people that they otherwise wouldn't hear. Voices like mine are usually blocked out from being heard on radio. And so social media also gives us an opportunity to bring out a lot of truths and for like political minds to connect. Go ahead.
Exactly. You're right. You know, with this, and that's why I really thank Blog Talk Radio for allowing us this avenue, and I pray to God that the government has nothing to do with Blog Talk Radio, because if it did have something to do with Blog Talk Radio, we wouldn't be able to say the things that we want to say.
Yeah, they would be controlling it.
Exactly. There's so many other shows that are doing what we're doing. We're not the only ones. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of shows that if you take time out, you can listen to on Blog Talk that have these same issues.
I've talked on a couple of them. Reverend Pickney's show up in Bell Harbor, Michigan.
Yes.
And Lady Fatima.
Uh-huh.
I've been on her show. Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
And one of my comrades up in Detroit are telling me about one up there because they mentioned Bobby Seale's going to be on one next week. I'm going to try to do a show there to constantly try and disseminate a lot of information and also connect people so that they can actually get involved in some active things that we're doing to try to bring light to a lot of oppressive things that's happening to black people. Trayvon Martin trial is coming up June 10th, and I'm trying to rally and organize around that. I want to do some major stuff down there. I haven't really come up with the funding yet, but my heart is in it. And also, I want to organize a national conference in America, and hold it at a huge facility, and a national conference of families, of persons, families who have lost loved ones to police murder, the word murder first, even before brutality. And if you add up the amount of lives that's been lost by racist white men in police uniforms against blacks and Latinos and poor whites in this country, I think we could pack that conference, and this is something that I'm going to seek the support of your radio show for. Me and Alan Bluford are trying to map some strategy for this right now. They have an organization called JAB, which is Justice for Alan Bluford. Again, that's the young black teenager, 18, just before he even graduated from high school. The Oakland police shot him down like a dog and just murdered him, and again, there's been no accountability for that murder. Matter of fact, it's the first time I ever heard a police chief apologize to the city for killing somebody, and the Oakland police chief did. And so I think that the struggle is starting to get on the high tide again, like it was back in the 60s. And as we know, oppression brings about resistance. And there's just every time you turn around, there's another killing. The one in Jonesboro, Arkansas, really took the case. Remember the young man who he was handcuffed, and they said he shot himself in the head? He was left-handed, but he supposed to shot himself in the right temple. You know, they search you before you get in the police car. Where did he get a gun? And no one believed him. What happened? They took it out of the minds of the people. They took it out of the press, and it just has died. So many injustices to black people. Marissa Alexander, I keep bringing that up. the young woman who had an abusive husband, used to beat her all the time. She shot in the air in Florida, and they gave her 20 years in prison. And Angela Corey,
justify that, 20 years for shooting in the air?
Well, they passed a law that's very much targeted all the blacks in Florida. Over 60% of the population in Florida have been to prison. And it's called 20-25 in life. If you have a gun and you're not supposed to have it, I think they can give you automatic 10 or 15 years. If you use the gun, you get 20. If you shoot somebody with it, it's 25 to life.
Wow.
You know, it's kind of like the habitual law in California, the three strikes law. Go ahead.
Hadn't it been to where she had called police several times on this man and nothing was done?
He had beat her. And as you know, Salita, a woman is very vulnerable within, say, 7 days after she's birthed a child. And Marissa Alexander just had her baby, and here comes her abusive husband again. She had went and purchased her a weapon legally, was registered, and she shot in the air. I think the bullet went through the ceiling or a wall or something, just to get him to get away from her. And they gave this woman, with never been arrested in her life, this mother, 20 stiff years in prison. And if this is any peep and insight into the mentality of Angela Corey, the state prosecutor for the Fourth Circuit Court in the state of Florida. She's up in Jacksonville, and her terrain and responsibilities go all the way down into Central Florida. She's the one who's prosecuting George Zimmerman. Now, George Zimmerman's father was a magistrate in Virginia, Supreme Court magistrate in Virginia. And also the mother was a court clerk. And one of their friends who was a judge, they called him, and this is the reason why they didn't prosecute George in the very beginning when he killed Trayvon Martin. So, again, there's tyranny and the breakdown of the rule of law. And so here we have an upcoming trial with a woman who's a Republican who has a history of meeting out sentences unjustly to black people, and she's supposed to be prosecuting Zimmerman. I suspect, because all those legal people run in circles, she probably knows George Zimmerman's father, that she's going to throw the legal advantage into the court or the camp of George Zimmerman and purposely try to get George Zimmerman off. And what's going to be the result of that? Black people will be indignated. They'll go out in the street and riot, and more of our people go get killed. And this one has national implications, just like the Emmett Till murder. It's not going to be a response in Florida. Go ahead.
We're going to take a break. Hold on. We're going to take a 5-minute break because we're at the top of the hour.
Okay. Top of the untalked whole hour?
We'll be back with Through the Eyes of the Black Woman on the Say Your Peace Radio Network, you guys.
Took a 5-minute.
Evidential. We filled up the cemetery.
What?
We filled up the jail. everything and stop all the wars.
You guys, if you know who that is, Mr. Coleman, who's that? Oh, I got everybody on mute.
Okay, I'm unmuted right now, just heard.
Yeah, I'm on.
Listen, before I forget, Brian, let me
say that was Chili Mose. Hold up, Mr. Houston. No, that was Chili Mose. That's the song.
I like that. You have to send me a copy of that. That was some good political rap. I like it when the lyrics are something positive for our people to listen to.
He's out in L.A.
He's out. Yeah. What's his name now? Chili who?
Chili Most.
Someone Stop the Violence. Listen, here in El Paso, about a month ago, there's a bodybuilder here. He looks like a slim Arnold Schwarzenegger. And he was in the county jail here in El Paso merely for traffic tickets. And so he must have got pretty ill because they were transporting him from the county jail to a hospital. And as you know, if you've ever been in a county jail, if you get sick, they usually give you a Tylenol and just tell you to lay down and be quiet. So when they got him right outside the county jail, he's handcuffed and shackled. The police shot him to death handcuffed. Danielle Danny Sines is his name. And these are the kind of things that are taking place, again, when I talk about law enforcement abuse. Now, nothing has been done about it. The police chief here, Chief Allen, saying nothing. There's been no public outcry. I spoke about it on Talk Radio 1150. I just called in. But it's just amazing how something like this can happen. I mean, anybody knows that you're not very much of a threat. The man was obviously very ill. How is it they end up shooting a man to death? Nobody's held accountable for something like that. The other thing I want to point out is, as I speak on the radio all around the United States, and I'm getting very, very, very active in doing different shows, for the listening audience out there, I want them to know the difference between the original Black Panther Party, which I'm part of that leadership from 1967, compared to a group led by Malik Zulu Shabazz calling himself the New Black Panther Party. There's no such thing. Chief of Staff David Hilliard of the original Black Panther Party runs the Huey P. Newton Foundation and put out a public statement making a very lengthy factual argument to this fact. As you know, Salita, the Buffalo Soldiers made their history. I couldn't say I was a new Buffalo Soldier. I wasn't living in 1866. How could I be part of that history? The Tuskegee Airmen was around during World War II. If an organization was to call itself the New Tuskegee Airmen, that's not realistic. If you weren't a Tuskegee Airman in the 40s, you couldn't be one now. And the same goes for SNCC, Student Nonviolating Coordinating Committee. There's no such thing as a new SNCC, a new Nation of Islam, and there definitely is no new Black Panther Party. And so I don't want people to get myself confused with this group. In my opinion, they're xenophobic racists. The Black Panther Party always stated that we would never stoop to the level of the Ku Klux Klan and hate another person merely because of the color of their skin. Revolutionaries, and Che Guevara said this very profoundly, are motivated out of the love for people, not the hatred of our enemies. And this has always been the Black Panther Party's position. We work with all racial groups across the board. We didn't have any members in the Black Panther Party. We wouldn't accept any white members because of the counterintelligence program. It'd make it too easy, as you know, for the FBI to infiltrate. But we would have solidarity with groups like the Progressive Labor Party, the Students for Democratic Society. You remember John Brown in history that took over Harper's Ferry, was trying to arm his slaves and other fighters against the slavers. And it was a group called the John Brown Society. So there were a lot of progressive white organizations that we were in solidarity with. And as a result of those correct politics, we were loved by all the American people. And the Black Panther Party has never been a racist organization. Even though they tried to paint us as that, we were not. And so for this organization to come along later in the future, assuming that all the original members are not active or dead, and be arrogant and call themselves the new Black Panther Party, what they're doing is they're trying to graft the Black Panther Party's history, the legacy, and the bloody sacrifices of my comrades onto themselves. And a lot of young people born in the 70s and the 80s don't know the difference. So I have to say this publicly, that there is no new Black Panther Party because they weren't Black Panther Party members at all. They've taken the party's name, Khalid Muhammad, who's dead now. He was part of the Nation of Islam. And I told one of the brothers in the nation, for example, Brian, you're a member of the Nation of Islam. Imagine someone coming along saying the new Nation of Islam. Elijah Muhammad built that organization. And also Minister Farrakhan, they're the ones that did all that work for all these decades. And for someone to come along and try to steal those men and all their sacrifice, many Muslims died. I remember the eight that got shot dead in Los Angeles way back, I think it was 1964 or 65. You remember when they shot all those Muslims to death?
That's right.
Shot eight of them to death. And for someone to come along and try to steal your history, try to graft that bloody sacrifice and all the work you did upon themselves and then represent you in that name while their ideology and their way of thinking and their guiding principles are something totally different.
Right.
And I'm constantly at odds with these young brothers. They're being misled by their leader who has no history. And they also don't have any following by the general public. You cannot wage any type of liberation movement in this country unless you have the express support of the masses of the people. And this is why we always said all power to the people, because we are nothing, Salita and Brian, without the people's support. Any type of political initiative that we will want to organize in America around any issue, we need the people to support us, not just blacks, everybody. And you see that in Dr. King and the work that they did. It wasn't just black people walking down in the South. You remember Cheney and what's the other civil rights worker that died in Mississippi? Goodman.
I know who you're talking about. The lady, you think about the lady who left her family in Detroit, I think. She lived in Detroit or somewhere in Michigan, and she left her family to come down to Mississippi to help them vote, and they killed her.
And so how then do we go around and take that same sick mentality, inhumanity, and look at a person and say, I don't like you because of the color of your skin? Our people are not racist. We never have been racist.
You don't have
and
the power
I resent,
to be racist.
And I resent the fact that they're going around. They fit the description of what the FBI's counterintelligence program called a sham tactic. And this is when they fabricate a phony revolutionary organization, and then they go out and do a bunch of idiotic things in order to turn the masses of people away from following organizations with those types of resistance ideology. That's what they are. I wrote about this on Facebook. They, to me... And I don't know if I mentioned this, but in 1975, I did a radio show with Howard at Howard University with Robert Taylor. They had a jazz show there, and they have a political show on the weekend. And so I was talking about how the FBI used their counterintelligence program to try and destroy the Black Panther Party. The Senate subcommittee, led by Senator Frank Church, over the Senate, who was investigating the wrongdoings of the Central Intelligence Agency, subpoenaed me to testify on the Frank Church committee, in which I did in 1975. And during that time, I got very much involved in understanding counterintelligence tactics by intelligence organizations because, as you know, the Black Panther Party were the main victims of it. They murdered many of my comrades. They killed Fred Hampton and Mark Clark in Chicago. John and Bunchy Carter were murdered in Los Angeles. Lil Bobby Hutton was shot dead in Oakland 2 days after they murdered Martin Luther King on April 6th. We refer to it as the April 6th shootout. And so one of the tactics that they had was that they would fabricate these fake organizations and then have them go do negative things. For example, I don't know if you remember the film The Spook Who Sat by the Door. That was the book by Sam Greeley. There were revelations inside the book of something called the SLA, the Symbionese Liberation Army. And what they did is they fabricated the SLA. They took an agent named Donald Dufresne. He was locked up in Vacaville Prison. And he started a one-man organization called the Unicide Project. I think I covered this on your show last time I talked about it, didn't I, Salita?
Yeah.
I think I pointed that out, yeah. So that was a fabricated organization. And when I looked at this group, go ahead.
No, I'm sorry to interrupt you. Now, that is also the group, and if anybody's not familiar with Patricia Hearst, remember Patricia Hearst?
Right, Patty Hearst, right. The
Patty
newspaper
Hearst?
Tycoon,
yes.
Randolph Hearst, owned the San Francisco Chronicle, and he
That's
had kidnapped
right.
his daughter. And then she supposedly joined them and pulled off a bank robbery, and they killed Marcus Foster. They shot him with shotgun with cyanide-laced bullets, and they pulled off this free food thing that was a sham down in Lower East Oakland on East 18th and Park Boulevard. All these things were a sham tactic. And I think I also mentioned the Jim Jones debacle down there in Jonestown, Guyana. In 1968, the FBI put together one of these sham tactics, and they presented themselves as being a revolutionary organization. And they held a conference, and then they invited all of the real grassroots revolutionary organizations to that conference. And all the while, the people that was putting the conference on were agents. And this is the type of things that they do. And so if you look at this group very closely, they have no roots in the community. Most of them came from the Nation of Islam, okay? Mm-hmm. Nothing's wrong with the Nation of Islam. But when they came from that organization, from them, to take the Black Panther Party, an organization that has worldwide political clout in countries like Cuba, China, North Korea, Algiers, and around the world, an organization that many, many of its members died, doing long terms in prison, that sacrifice, and I'm part of that movement. And the last thing I'm going to allow them to do is to pimp the party's history and the legacy of my bloody comrade that died for their people. Okay? I've told Malik Zulu Shabazz this. that this will not stand. There's no room for no negotiation. And they just recently went to South Africa, and they met with the Pan-Africanist Congress over there. And I spoke to one of their leaders. His name is Chris Sankara. And I put the statement from the Huey P. Newton Foundation on his website, and that created a little bit of fuss from them. So right now I'm at odds with this organization. But, you know, black people, especially my age, they know who the original Black Panther Party members were. They know it was Huey Newton. It was Eldridge Cleaver. It was Stokely Carmichael. Angela Davis was associated with us, but she was a member of another organization, even though she was in love with George Jackson. You see, all of this struggle, all of the work that we did, all of the survival programs that we implemented around this country, showing our people love, and they would attempt to graft all of that history upon themselves and call themselves the Black Panthers and just simply put the word new on the front of it. There's no such animal. And I want the public out there listening to know this. And if you see these individuals, do not confuse them with the original Black Panther Party, in which I have been part of for over 45 years. And we have an organization made up of over 150 original party members. A lot of them are up in age and around the country doing different things. It's called the NAABPP. It stands for National Alumni Association Black Panther Party. And they hold a reunion every so often. The last one was in Oakland and North Carolina. I think last year was in Philadelphia and Oakland. 1 year we had it in seven different cities. Bobby Seale is still active. He's attempting to make a film right now. It's called The Eighth Defendant. David Heard, who was the chief of staff, he runs the Huey P. Newton Foundation in Oakland. Billy X is a curator for the Black Panther Party. And if you go online and you go to It's About Time, you can pick up on all the current information that original Black Panther Party members are still active in doing. I myself stand out amongst all my comrades, and I'm the one, I think, who's still fighting. I'm the one that's still going to get out there and do battle with my enemies, in, if it's necessary, in a military fashion. I'm a soldier. I can't get that out of my heart and mind. Every time I hear about another police murder of one of my black children, especially this latest murder of Kamani Kiki Gray up there in New York, they shot him while he was begging for his life. That National Guardsman, Noel Polanke, the police pulled over and shot him in his stomach, killed him, active National Guard soldier. And that's another thing. The police are murdering our veterans. They killed up in White Plains, New York, Kenneth Chamberlain. He was a 69-year-old Vietnam veteran, a senior, living by himself. He had one of those heart alert systems on, and it went off accidentally. Police came to his house, and he was in his underwear. He went to the door, and he said, "Officers, I'm doing fine." It went off accidentally. They kept on insisting that they come in. He kept saying, "I'm fine." For some reason, they got to calling him the N-word, racial slurs. They took the hinges off the door, Salita. Went in there, they shot him with a beanbag first and a taser and then with bullets. His son is trying to get justice right now. Nothing has been done about them shooting that Vietnam veteran.
I think what needs to be, I guess, said and the public really needs to know, and I'll say it, is that this American government don't care about no veteran. They are nothing.
They don't.
It's just like you... like a hunter out in the woods with his coon dog. He got 50 coon dogs hunting. He like get all of them back to hunt again, but if he lose one, he'll just replace him. And that's the fact of what they think about people. And it's just,
and let me piggyback on top of what you're saying, Brian. We'll say it like this. Their racism, their institutionalized racism is stronger, Brian, than their patriotism. And we
have many
facts of this. It was a soldier came home from World War II. He had so many medals on him, he looked like a Christmas tree. He went down in the South in Alabama to visit his family. They hung him in his uniform. Do you remember all the black men? You've seen the Tuskegee Airmen movie, Red Tails. Do you remember all the revelations of what they did to black soldiers, even though we fought for their country? Their racism is stronger than their patriotism. And Barack Obama, although he's naive and he thinks that because he's 50% this and 50% that, that was going to excuse him from being a victim of institutionalized racism, he found out different when he became the president because the Republicans are obstructing every initiative that he tries to do. Is a prime example, because just like military soldiers that serve in the military, the president is a soldier. He's the commander-in-chief. And look how they treat the commander-in-chief, the top military person, that they don't care how good and how great this man does for this country. They hate him because he got some African blood. And this is the biggest shame about this country. They have not tried to deal with this. You're down there in Louisiana where racism is running amok. It's in Orleans Parish. It's all down there in the South. They didn't vote for Barack Obama. Look how ridiculous this is.
Well,
they might have got some votes, but I'm just saying, as far as when you tallied up the whole vote in the state, it was what they called a red state.
It's considered a red state.
And Governor Jindal, and we've always known that the state of Louisiana is wholly controlled by the mafia. You remember when Katrina hit, and they were talking about they didn't trust giving the money to the people of Louisiana because of the mafia influence, that all that money was going to end up in the hands of the mafia and the people weren't going to get any.
Right.
Louisiana has a history, especially I used to go to I used to eat at Papa Joe's down in the French Quarter back in when I ran the New Orleans chapter of the Black Panther Party. They had the best spaghetti and garlic bread down there, but everybody knew that Papa Joe's was wholly controlled by the mafia. And that's who brought all that gambling into the state of Louisiana. That is one corrupt state. When David Duke ran for governor, he got I think he got 45% of the vote of the state, the people of the state of Louisiana. So you can measure the degree of racism by how many people voted for a Ku Klux Klan leader this late in the century.
Yeah, you're right.
David
Duke. Right about it.
Even though he put a suit and tie on instead of wearing a sheet. But the racism is still there, and it's still there in Louisiana.
It's very prevalent here in Louisiana, and it's also prevalent in Florida. It's also
in
very
Florida,
prevalent
in
South
Florida.
Carolina and North Carolina.
And it's in New York.
What
did Malcolm say? He said that there are wolves in the South and foxes in the North.
Mm-hmm.
And they all belong to the dog family, and they all canine. And this is talking about their culture.
Mm-hmm.
This is talking about their culture.
Yep. You learn about that. I want to see if this person wants to talk. We have 111. Would you like to say something?
You want to call in?
Yeah, a call in. I have somebody. Do you want to
I'll take
something?
A call. Sure, go ahead. Let the person speak.
Just listen.
Hello?
Just listening.
You're just listening? Okay. Gotcha. Thank you.
Okay. Well, thanks for listening in, brother, whoever that is. Yeah.
Yeah, we're trying to make sure all my friends, let me say this, on the Facebook and Internet, I'm hitting quite a few of them. So some of them are telling me they're going to be tuning in, so we should be getting some more coming in because I finally got to a landline phone.
Oh, okay. We'll discuss this off air.
You know,
go ahead.
I was in the French Quarter in New Orleans a few years back, and I went and looked at some historical things. There were two brothers down there who fought with Andrew Jackson during the war. They had stashed a whole lot of gold down there, and they were still looking for the gold of these two. I'm trying to remember the name. Brian, you know.
In New Orleans?
Yeah, in Louisiana. They're historical. They had French names. I know they.
I'm lost
the Lafitte. The Lafitte brothers.
Okay.
Yeah. And it was engraved in the wall. They said that, and they had locked him up in a jail, and they escaped. So they had a wanted poster, and they said wanted. I think it was Henry and Pierre Lafitte. $1,000 reward, and they also had four slaves that escaped with them. But the bounty on the slaves was only $50. But the Lafitte brothers had $1,000, and they were pirates, and fought with Andrew Jackson when it was at the Battle of Orleans, of New Orleans. I think when the French came in there, and they had a big battle down there. But what was interesting, they had bought the Lafitte project. You know how they tore down all the projects in New Orleans, the St. Bernard, the Callio, the Melpomene, the Desire. When Katrina hit, they used it as an opportune time to destroy all that low-income housing so the blacks really wouldn't have nowhere to come back to because they really didn't need them anymore. They had the Riverwalk. The casinos up and down Canal Street, all the restaurants down in the French Quarter. And they had brought the Lafitte Project. I think they will turn that into a casino named after Pierre and Henry Lafitte, these two brothers, in the history of New Orleans during the slave trade. You familiar with that?
I've kind of heard something like that, yeah.
Okay.
I'm fuzzy on the New Orleans. I mean, on the actual New Orleans itself. They don't teach much of that. So what I've learned,
and that's
you don't get that trees in
Brian.
History. You get the fluff.
Yeah. We were talking about
that. So we have to dig
fact,
it out. So that's somewhere I hadn't dug out yet. I'll be honest.
I actually like the culture of Northern Louisiana, where you guys at Alexandria, Monroe, Shreveport, Baton Rouge, you know, Lafayette. Orleans Parish seemed to be so vicious. There's so much killing going on there, blacks killing each other, the heroin, the drug use, and the police corruption. It just makes for a very ugly city. I mean, we know they got the Mardi Gras and all of the history and the culture. The food is good, but there's just so many deadly things taking place in New Orleans. I'd prefer to go to Alexandria or out there where you at in Pine. What is it, Pine Ridge?
Pineville.
Yeah, I'd rather be out in the country.
Well, it's more of a retirement area. Not a lot going on here. But you have to understand, too, we're in a situation where racism is very, very, very much so prevalent where we're at also. So we get it just as bad as the big cities do. It's more of them being in a smaller town. It's more inclusive because you have only a couple of people that's in charge that making decisions, and if they have that racial attribute about them, then you're going to deal with that on a daily basis with business and everything you do. So
let me just say this. You know, as we sit and we discuss and point out all of the different things that's going on in our world, from racism to all the other evils, at some point we must discuss what's going to be the remedy. What action are we going to take? What are we going to organize? How are we going to move forward to try to eradicate this? And that's where my mind is at. I'm for action. I'm for organizing things that's going to have an effect to begin to make a change for all these things. This struggle that me and you, Brian and Salita, and all the other activists in this world involved in has been going on a long, long time. They have passed the baton to us. We're living now in 2013. Dr. King is dead. Malcolm is dead. Medgar Evers is dead. Fannie Lou Hamer. Rosa Parks is gone. But they all contributed. They all contributed toward this struggle. And when you read about other struggles in other countries, sometime it took them over 150 years to finally change societies. You know, and this is why we understand, the Black Panther Party, we study something called dialectical materialism. And this is a science of understanding life and how there's change, and change leads to development. And this is how societies go from one level of whatever that is to changing in time. And so we need to focus in on what are we going to do to eradicate all of these evils that's taking place in our world. Time has already changed a lot. We can look back and see a lot of things that have changed. And there's going to be more change in the future. To me, the biggest challenge right now is ending these extrajudicial killings that's taking place in America. This is what affects me more passionately
than anything, and I understand that. I'm sorry to interrupt you. But when you say that, and me and Brian talks about this all the time on our other show, if the people are not educated about their history, we're not going to be able to change anything. Let me say that again. If our people are not educated about their history, you can't change anything.
Can I interject something here?
Go ahead, Brian.
I want to kind of come behind what Salita just said.
And I totally agree with her. Go ahead.
I'm while we're talking, I'm always on the internet sending out information that you need to be on this show. But just what she just said,
it's very key.
I was told just a second ago that this brother, talking about you, Brother Houston, he's stuck in the past. Needs to live for the future. And think about what this person just said. This person, Eldon Pittman Jr.
Let me respond to Eldon Pittman Jr. Because, you know, Brian, this is not the first time I held it. Let me put things in perspective.
Okay.
The way the world is today, Salita and Brian and all those listening out there, is based on what happened yesterday. The foundations for the present is the past. And the way this world will be in the future for our children and grandchildren is based on what we do today. It is not nostalgia. It is not irrelevant to study the things in the past. How else can we understand why our world is the way it is today if we don't examine what happened yesterday in the past? That is the most ignorant statement that any person could ever make. I've heard stuck in the past. I have evolved from the past. I have begun my struggle when I was 17 years old. I'm 62 years, and I have never stopped. I have never stopped struggling for the liberation and freedom of my race and my people and all the injustices that's been done to them. I've heard this ignorant, illogical statement, and I say it's ignorant because what Salita just said is very important. One of the main things that the Black Panther Party always told its members, what our main job was to educate, to raise the level of consciousness about things in this world of our people. And if we didn't educate them, Salita, if we didn't bring that level of consciousness up, what they can understand, our movement wasn't going anywhere. This was our main job as revolutionaries, as freedom fighters in this country, that we're going to have a movement, an organization, we're going to have to educate the masses of the people. So when you hear people say, he's stuck in the past, what they're referring to is when you make revelations about things that happen in history, they find that irrelevant because they don't understand that it's very relevant to understand your history. Unless you teach your children about the past, how can they understand how things became the way that they are today? How can they understand why whites in this country have all the money and live the good life, while their lives are so different from ours, if they don't know what happened during the slave trade, if they don't realize that blacks didn't earn any money for 400 years? How can they understand how great kings and queens we were and how we had great civilizations in Africa and Nubia and Wawat and Kush if they don't study the past?
What we have to understand is, and we're caught in this materialistic society in which we live, and the first thing that when you hear someone speak like this that's supposed to be black, I call them Orioles, but they're supposed to be black, like Mr. Eldon Pittman Jr., we're asking about someone's portfolio,
versus them. Just think about if we had fighters like the Most Honorable Elijah Muhammad, Noble Drew Ali, Dr. King, Marcus Garvey. If those gentlemen would have worried about their financial portfolio, this is what he wants to know about somebody's financial portfolio. If they worried about that, they're gone on now. Where would we be today if we didn't have people like yourself that blazed the trail for those bourgeois Negroes, that's what I call them, able to come now, they can slide through on the butter after somebody else and have to lit the fire and heat up the skillet. You see now, you understand where I'm coming from?
Yeah, living in the past. First of all, that's the most illogical statement. The past is the past. How can I be living in the past?
Right,
what they're referring to is like to hear
people like that speak out of, I don't say it's ignorance, stupidity, because he knows better. He's a year younger than you are, so he knows better. He knows what the struggle was. So he out of stupidity, because they are beholden to the crumbs that the master kicks off his
and
table.
He probably don't care. He's just an individual, and he only worries about his individual pursuits in life. He doesn't care about his people. We have so many of our people that don't care about our people. They only care about them individual self. And that's been taught to them, to be an individual, to not seek unity in their community. And you'd be surprised that when they go to church, this same individual probably goes to church. And he sits up there and listens to his pastor read the Bible, which is what? Isn't that a great historical account of the past?
Right.
No, that's the Bible.
But the Bible is an account of historical things that happened in the past.
That's right.
And they love to bring that up. They don't tell the pastor he's living in the past when he talk about Samuel and Ezekiel and Exodus and all those other books. Why don't he tell them you living in the past? Jesus did this and God did this.
Jesus,
that's the pastor talking about. We love that Bible, so we obviously love reading about the past. So that's just you know, I've heard that illogical statement so many times, Brian. And you know, when I had a radio show here, and I'd have people, oh, you're living in the past. Oh, I am, huh?
Yeah,
you know, I meant to bring this up. In 1884, at the villa of a chancellor of Germany, his name was Otto von Bismarck. He held a conference. It's referred to as the Berlin Conference. You might have heard of it, Brian. He invited over 16 heads of nations from all over Europe, France, England, Belgium, the Netherlands, that's the Dutch government, Germany, they all met to decide how they was going to divide up Africa. Africa was 90% still in control by the indigenous population in Africa. And they went into Africa and they divided it up, giving the Germans Namibia, and the Portuguese took Mozambique and Angola, and the French took Chad, Libya, Algiers, the Morocco, the Sudan, Azerbaijan. Spain took the Canary Islands. And you can see a map showing the British and what they call Rhodesia, the African name was Zimbabwe, and King Leopold going into the Congo. They murdered over 10 million Africans still in rubber and cobalt. And when we study all of these things, we find that before the Industrial Revolution, when a man needed oil, the main precious commodities were diamonds and gold. And they found in Kimberley, 90% of the world's volcanic ash pipe, that's what produces diamonds in South Africa. A few years later, they found 80% of the world's gold deposits along the Vaal River. They also found radium, which sold for $120,000 a gram way back in 1920. God gave us Africa. The Chinese come from China. The French come from France. The Germans come from Germany. There is no country called Negro. We are Africans and descendants of Africa. And so once you consider the fact that we do have a nationalism, that we did come from a nation, and that that nation was so rich with mineral wealth that if only we had been left alone. You know, Marcus Garvey talks about this a lot in his book, The Philosophies and Opinion of Marcus Garvey. If we had not been occupied by first Arabs who brought Arab Islam into Africa, and then second by European Christianity, mainly the Portuguese, if Africa had been let alone and allowed to develop, look how rich black people in this world would be. So when we point out these historical facts that are the reasons for our sufferings today, it is so ignorant to say a person is living in the past because we want to teach history to our people so they can understand what happened to our race. It's very important to understand. We also would like to point out the fact that they were kings and queens and had great dynasties in Africa. A good book for all you listeners out there to read is The Destruction of Black Civilization by Chancellor Williams. It's the most in-depth factual study of African history ever written. It was written way back in the 60s, The Destruction of Black Civilization by Chancellor Williams. And so people need to understand that basic logic. The foundations for the present are based on the past. Even in our own bodies as human beings, to understand our inner selves, we have to look at our mothers and fathers, don't we? And our grandmothers and fathers. And that continues to go back. Are you to say that your body does not exist from things that came through the past? Of course it does. All your DNA goes back millions of years in the past. So, you know, as Salida said earlier, the most important thing that we have to do is educate our people. And if we fail to do that, we failed in our struggle to get this freedom and liberation that we're seeking. It's the most important thing that we have to do. And if you notice, it's been a battle for those in power to control the minds of our people so that they will end up being warped like this. What's his brother's name, Brian, that you mentioned?
It's Edmund Pittman Jr.
Pittman Jr. I hope he's listening right now.
I hope he is, but he left. He was in a black group, and he got out when I called him out on another issue and stayed in it. But he stays in his white group, so he's one of those types. He runs from the truth, so.
Yeah,
you want
to say he runs from the truth. Yeah, and you know there's many more like Edmund Pittman Jr. There's a lot of Edmund Pittman Jr.'s out there, and what we can do, but we try to save those that we can. All of them ain't gonna come around, but I think it's enough of us to come around that we can move forward and do something about changing our situation in this world. And
I was making sure I got that name. I wasn't on the thing looking at it, but I'm making sure
Salita,
I got that.
Say something because you haven't said a word. I'm doing all the talking.
I know you got something on your mind, sister. No, I was just thinking about what he's saying, and it's going to be devastating, and I'm going to use that word. That's a very deep word to use, devastating, when a lot of our black brothers and sisters do not want to wake up. They're I'm comfortable in my life. They don't bother me. I work with them. I do this with them. I don't have to worry about that. But I did with them too. I still deal with them. I have to.
You know,
one of the main things I think that's hurting us now, both of you guys will probably agree, is the music of the times right now. There's nothing wrong with the rap music and the beat, but the lyrics are destructive to our community.
Yeah.
What they're
yeah.
rapping about is so negative. Yeah. And they're planting yeah. these thoughts in the minds of these young people,
yeah.
and then they actually go out in the street and do these crazy things. They're disrespectful of their women, calling them, you know, the B-word and this and that. They're promoting the black-on-black killing in the black community. You know, me and you grew up when, you know, Stevie Wonder and James Brown was talking about it. I'm black and I'm proud. Marvin Gaye was brother, singing all these songs about love. Almost every other word that came out of R&B had the words love in it. We listened to good jazz and vocal. And what happened?
You know, one of the things.
The flamboyant dressing. Listen, Brian. that the black men wore beautiful suits, beautiful colors, that they've now succumbed to wearing their pants down below their butt with their skid mark underwear showing. That's disrespect to our race and to a man. And so when they say I'm living in the past, well, wow, some of the past was some of the best cultural things about our race, because it darn sure ain't in the future right now. Look at our future. If these are the young men that's going to be running the future in the world, we're going to be living in a sad world. I'm be glad I won't be living. If what I'm seeing now going to be running our community, I mean, it's horrible what's going on. All the black on black killing. And the promotion of homosexuality. They got them self-genocide now. They got the black men not making babies. We can't make no babies with two men and two women. That's depopulation, but they're not talking about that.
But you got to understand, too, when you're talking about the music industry, and you made a good point with the music industry, but you guys got to understand who runs the music industry. Black folk think that black folk in charge in the music industry. Let me tell you, let me get you enlightened. The Jewish people run the music industry.
That's right.
Let me say that again. The Jewish people run, just like they run a lot of things that we think white folks and black folks run.
I think they killed Otis Redding.
Jewish.
That's the mafia killed Otis Redding because he wouldn't play along.
Well, a lot of them, they said that happened to a lot of them that refused to play
along.
And
they were in control of Motown out of Detroit.
Well, when Motown moved out of Detroit and moved to Los Angeles, that's when Motown really, really lost what it had. The naturality
of
the black culture when they were in Detroit was there. When Berry Gordy packed up and moved them people to Los Angeles, everything changed.
And you know what else is interesting, Salita? The fact that it was our music. It was our voices. But look who was in control of it. On the management end.
When you hear those songs being played, our people are not getting paid for that.
Nope.
That's why they hated Michael Jackson so much. I'm pretty sure there was a hit out on Michael.
Yes.
Oh, yeah, most definitely.
Yeah, they murdered Michael Jackson.
Whenever we hear these oldie but goodie songs, every time they've been played, it's a little bit being paid out. But the people who sung the songs are not getting a dime because they didn't own their own.
And look how they're using them in commercials now. Look how they're using all that R&B from the past way back in commercials.
And they're getting paid. Those who own the song is the one that's getting paid for those commercials. You're right.
Yes, that's exactly
right. Notice they never would, as popular as Michael Jackson still is and was.
Mm-hmm.
Do you ever notice they never, ever would use any of his songs in commercials?
Nope.
Because he was the one going to be getting paid. Do you ever notice that?
He was controlling.
Yeah.
The same way, if you look at BET, I want y'all to think back. Before Bob Johnson sold BET, we saw more PSAs played on that station than we did commercials because he couldn't hardly get them. As soon as he sold BET, they're bombarded with commercials. Have you noticed that?
Yeah.
I noticed that.
So
and I noticed every time I
to make any money. And we have these foolish Negroes out here that's always running to the master's table and putting his own down instead of looking. And just like you said, our history dictates us, and we got to start looking at things and looking at reality that's in our face, and we don't even realize.
It's just like the food that black people cook. We cook the most delicious food. Look at you guys down in Louisiana and all that delicious Cajun food. That came from black folks' recipes all the way back to slavery. Somebody pointed this out. How come we can't go to a supermarket, a big supermarket like Albertson, a Winn-Dixie, a Piggly Wiggly's or something like that, and them same delicious chicken and dumplings, collard greens, a jambalaya, whatever we eat, is packaged with a patent on it. And in the store, we can just buy it, open up the can, and dump it out, and it tastes just like grandma's. How come? How come we haven't patented the delicious food that we make? Again, even all of that is under control by the powers that be.
That's right.
Food are. I think there's only one item, and I know you guys have probably tried this. What do they call them, glory greens?
Yes.
Come in the can.
That's
about the closest thing that has the taste the way our people cook our food. And as delicious as our soul food is, Ain't nothing back. I think one sister I know, she makes, what they call them, pork skin, chicharrones in Spanish. Other than that, that market is completely dominated by, and that's one thing I've always respected about the Nation of Islam, Brian, is that Elijah Muhammad all the way back was always saying, do for self, organize your own economic empires. And that brings up Black Wall Street. You remember what happened?
Right.
Dick
Rose,
17-year-old black boy, supposed to rape Sarah Page, the elevator operator. I went to.
And she lied.
Yeah, I went to Tulsa, Oklahoma, a few years back, and I met with those survivors. I even went to the church that was burnt down and sit with the pastor of that church. I stayed there about 4 months in Tulsa and did a lot of research on Black Wall Street. They dropped nitroglycerin from bombs. They killed over 3,500 black people, over 40 square blocks, burned it to the ground. Them blacks had their own cab companies, their own banks.
Yep.
They had oil on their land.
And what about Rosewood? We had one in Rosewood in Florida.
That was part of the Trail of Tears. The blacks had moved up into the center of the country in the Oklahoma area. There was no railroad up there, and they could live free away from Jim Crow during those days. And they lived amongst the different Indian tribes, the Choctaw, the Miccosukee, the Creeks. And they found oil on their land. One girl, she was getting something like $15,000 a month from the oil on their land. You know how much money that was in 1917?
That's
here come the railroad.
Today.
And here come now all the white races moving into the town. They must have had over 20,000 members of the Ku Klux Klan. And the tracks divided the north part of Tulsa from the south part. They called it Greenwood. Yes, ma'am.
We're down to 53 seconds.
Wow. Really? I talked that much?
Wow.
Yes, you
I really enjoyed this. And to all the listeners out there, I'd love to be back on the show again.
Yes,
you can
I
contact me on
you
Facebook.
Back.
You can bring up Victor Houston on Facebook. Send me a friend's request. I have a lot of information I share. I'm also on Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
And I really enjoyed the show today. I probably strayed and went to a lot of different subject matters, but, you know,
I'm just
kind of letting
but
it flow naturally,
right.
Brian. And,
okay, you guys, I'm going to have to let it go. I thank you guys for listening in. Thank you, Mr. Houston, for your time. We will be bringing you back. I want to say thank you to my co-host, Ryan. I'll see you Tuesday. You guys have a great weekend. Love you.
All power to
bye-bye.
The people. Bye-bye.
This has been another episode of Through the Eyes of the Black Woman with your host, Salida. We want to thank you for listening in and stay tuned.